Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. Snap Judgment is stories made for summer. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we consider the matter of wildcards, the performers and creators who are sometimes delightful, sometimes disappointing, and sometimes just plain difficult. Then we'll return to one of our favorite regular features, the regrettable television pop quiz. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch project.
Wonderful. We are always happy to have you with us, Gene Demby.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we brought you in, you know, as we always do, to talk about a wide range of things that only a lead blogger
right.
can
this
really.
This is kind of a lead blogger topic.
This is a lead blogger kind of situation. Our first topic came to us from one of our listeners on our Facebook page who asked us to talk about wild cards. Glenn, can you talk a little bit about what we mean by this?
Yeah, it means inconsistency. And I'm going to make a case that inconsistency is a good thing, whether it's perceived inconsistency or if it's actual inconsistency. I think it means that somebody is trying. They have a voice. They have a vision. And I used to teach writing, and talent is raw, and a kid comes to you with raw talent, and you can throw skills on top of that and make them better than they are, no matter where they are. But there's an X factor, and that's vision. That's drive. That's, some people call it inspiration or the muse, which I don't like doing because that makes it sound magical, and it's not. It's actually a very self-directed thing. The vision is the thing that means that sometimes everything lines up well, and sometimes it doesn't. But because consistency sucks. Consistency is boring. Consistency means you're not trying.
How does that sound to you, Gene?
The Stones versus Beatles argument, right? A lot of times people say the Stones are much more interesting because they had some albums that were not as consistent as the Beatles, who had this like run of like excellence for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. But it goes against, I guess, the argument of being boring, because the Beatles weren't boring.
I didn't think they were.
Yeah, I feel like consistent excellence is not necessarily anything. Right.
I'm not sure I'm buying this.
We'll get into it.
But you like unpredictability. You like a certain amount of, there's genius in there, but you have to winnow it out.
Yeah, right? I like it not to think that they're coasting on skill, and they're actually trying to give something new, that they have a vision, that they have something they want to say. And sometimes that lines up with what you like, and sometimes it doesn't. I also think being able to perceive inconsistency is a good thing, too, because that means you're not a fanboy or a fangirl. That means you have nerdy passions are great and enthusiasm is wonderful. They tend to obliterate dispassion. They tend to obliterate nuance. So being able to say this worked, this didn't, that's a good thing.
Do you have an example of inconsistency that you admire?
Yeah. The writer Grant Morrison is a comic book writer, and he has. You talk about raw talent and skills and voice and vision. He's got it. I first came to know him from a comic back in the 80s called Animal Man. DC Comics basically threw a out-of-the-way character at him, a character who could absorb the powers of nearby animals. So it was kind of a joke character. He took that and over the course of 2 years turned it into an argument for animal rights and also a deconstruction of superhero storytelling, comic book storytelling, and narrative itself in a way. He went on to do my single favorite run of comics ever called The Doom Patrol, which is kind of the same thing. You take these ragtag bunch of misfits, but what he did was he infused that run of comics with surrealism and Dada and made it about something and just loaded the page up with ideas. He went on to do other things. The first thing he did that didn't work for me was The Invisibles. This is a comic series that posits that there are this ragtag group of misfits who are trying to expose what's really lurking under reality, man, with chaos magic and drugs and sex and all that kind of stuff. And what I learned there was that, at least as far as I'm concerned, this guy is so filled with ideas that when he has a big idea to kind of link up with, it works great. When it's all about him, it starts to feel like Joyce, like where all of a sudden it's about involution. It's about the self-confidence he has becomes self-regard.
Okay. And tell me what involution is.
Involution means just turning in on itself.
Okay.
Going up its own butt. Its own narrative butt.
Now, see,
I understand.
Yeah. I am the person who is not afraid to tell you that I need you to tell me that involution means going up your own
butt. No, that's fine. Fair enough. You know, I have friends who love that run of comics, who think it's his best work. These friends tend to be academics. They tend to use people who use words like involution and diegesis in a sentence in casual conversation. And they also tend to like to spend days footnoting. That's how you really appreciate this particular series.
I see.
But when he turns to something like Superman or Batman, which he's done. Yes, they're nuggets of intellectual property, but they're also big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he does something with both of those characters where he says, okay, every story that's ever been written about Superman, every story that's ever been written about Batman happened to this character is mm-hmm. true. We're not going to pick and choose from all these different things. We're going to make a story, a huge idea-laden megastory
sure.
that's about everything happening at once. And it lines up. That's the vision. That works. When he's doing something by himself, he did a series called The Filth, which I couldn't tell you what it's about if you paid me. And he's also done some good work, too, that's smaller. But that's an example. I noticed the inconsistency, but I think I can explain it. At least I'm, you know, going up my own butt to attempt it.
I was going to say, that was a very involuted argument.
There you go.
Well, it's interesting that you kind of bring up, we're starting to get the outlines of a taxonomy here. You're talking about, see, taxonomy is like the word I learned doing this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about specific tendencies of a creator, mm-hmm. an artist of some kind or another, that work in some settings and don't work in others. And I think that, you know, one of the names that I wrote down when I was thinking, we were talking about just wild cards, people, sometimes they're great, sometimes they suck. And one of the names that popped up that I found really interesting was Christopher Walken.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes Christopher Walken is great at being Christopher Walken, and sometimes Christopher Walken gets plopped into something, told be Christopher Walken, and it's terrible.
Uh-huh.
And it's because he has this certain set of tendencies that have become fairly rigid as he's gotten older and sort of, some would say, devolved into self-caricature.
Uh-huh.
Right.
The thing that he does makes him incredibly inconsistent.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because he's not a wild card, you know? He's the ace of spades every time. He does the thing he does. He's not the Joker. He doesn't change.
But sometimes it is considered a good performance and sometimes it is considered a bad performance.
I get what you're saying.
And the larger point that I'm trying to make here is that we very often tag these creators or performers as inconsistent when often the settings around them, like if you give an actor a bad enough script, you give Laurence Olivier a terrible script and it's going to suck.
Yeah.
You direct Laurence Olivier to do something a certain way, like talk like Sylvester the Cat in this scene. It's going to be bad.
Or you put him in the wrong thing. I mean, almost anybody can be miscast. Almost anybody, no matter how good they are, can be miscast. What do you think, Gene?
Well, I was going to ask Glenn if he felt that there were things about Grant Morrison's, things that he especially, that there were certain contexts that allowed him to succeed, where he did his best work, or are there things that were consistent with the stuff that you didn't like about his work?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying when he has a huge idea to play with, then this fact that he's loading up the page with all these ideas and certain things come and go, that works. That makes this universe feel deep. When it's just him saying, you know what, maybe there's this secret organization and blah, 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 Marquis de Sade, there's something that happens where he ceases to care about the reader. Like, the reader doesn't matter, and what matters is the story, because the story is self-aware, and it's a sentient being, and I'm making a rude gesture as I say for the listeners. But yeah, that's what I mean.
That is actually, it dovetails very nicely with Questlove, who is my person,
uh-huh.
who I find to be an incredible wild card. The Roots are my favorite group. I've said that a few times on the show. Their albums are wildly inconsistent. They were kind of on this upward trajectory until about Phrenology, and the last five or six albums they put out have been either really propulsive and interesting and weird and not altogether, or they've been like really dark and dreary and kind of hard to listen to. I've seen them in concert maybe north of two dozen times, and I find myself going to the shows always kind of like dreading like from which part of their catalog they're going to pull from, right? Or whether Questlove will decide that in the middle of a set he'll invite someone to do a 20-minute spoken word poem.
What do you think causes that inconsistency? Are they going in with different goals, or is it just execution?
I think he's sort of started to buy this idea of his own genius.
Often bad for anyone, I think.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, he's always held up as like this kind of nerd exemplar, this music nerd exemplar. And, you know, sometimes he just kind of goes down these rabbit holes of, like, I mean, like, no one cares. Like, no one cares what you're doing right now. Phrenology, which is an album that I really like. My girlfriend and I were talking about this yesterday. But there's this little kind of digression on the song called Water, which is supposed to be about one of their members who became a drug addict and dropped out of the group. And it's just really 7 minutes of noise. I mean, it's seven minutes of noise. I'm not joking. I'm not exaggerating. It's just sounds for 7 minutes in the middle of
jazz odyssey.
Absolutely.
But I mean, part of that group's genius is that reaching and searching quality.
Right.
That's my point.
This is part of what Glenn's getting
I'm
at.
I'm trying to get to the point that, like, even when it doesn't work for you, it's still interesting, as opposed to fill in the name of a pop person who's just cranking out, and just producing
like
something.
Like the Beatles.
Sure. Like that fly-by-night group.
No. Damn, no, their consistent excellence.
But I understand. I understand what you're saying. I think, for me, as I started to think about this, I found myself kind of gravitating to a couple of different kinds of people. And first, I was thinking about actors. I realized I was thinking about good-looking, charismatic dude actors, like Bradley Cooper is one where sometimes it really works for me. I thought he was wonderful in Silver Linings Playbook. Other times, it's so skeevy and I don't care for it at all, or it's not that interesting to me. I actually didn't think he was that interesting in American Hustle, to be honest. It really depends on how is he approaching the kind of natural slickness that he has. And I think that's the same thing that originally made an interesting turn in the career of a guy like Hugh Grant, who I think we've talked about this before, that, you know, originally was playing these kind of shy, stammery fop dudes. And then figured out he should be playing jackasses. Like, no, I'm way more interesting playing jackasses. And we touched on this when we talked about Tom Cruise a couple weeks ago, that when he's playing a slightly weaselly, slick person, he's more interesting than when he's just steering into having this glam face. Mm-hmm. So that was one category. Another was people who have sort of a big energy that if it's directed exactly right, it's interesting to me. And if it's wrong, I mean, Jack Black, right?
Okay.
That's a very good.
When you take that energy and either you make it a supporting thing, like in High Fidelity, it can work for me like that. Or like in Bernie, when it's really flipped around and he does a really different thing, it's still him and it still has a Jack Black-y quality to it, but in a different way, that can work for me. But when you just send him off to go and just be him, there are places where that's worked. I'm a big fan of School of Rock.
I am too.
I love School of Rock. Mm. But there are ones where if he's not directed right, it becomes just him being loud.
Well, just
and,
loud,
and
yeah.
terrible.
Well, example. I don't know the.
Isn't he in Year One?
Well, everything is terrible in Year One.
You can't single him out.
But no, but I am talking about, like, they expect his energy to carry a movie like that.
An actor that sprung to my mind, actually going back a ways, I think it was just last week, I mentioned how much I love the movie Some Like It Hot, which was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid, and I remember thinking, I really love this actor, Tony Curtis. And I was flipping through one of my parents' books, and it was, I believe it was like the Golden Turkey Awards, but it was like Michael Medved wrote it. And he named Tony Curtis the worst actor of all time. And I remember being just mortified. But if you watch Tony Curtis in certain things, Tony Curtis is terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, Tony Curtis had this kind of, you know, kind of poor man's Cary Grant qualities when directed properly. I mean, he was in some good movies. I mean, he was in The Defiant Ones. He was in Spartacus.
Right.
And he's fantastic in Some Like It Hot. But he's also known as just this ham in certain roles. He's wonderful in Some Like It Hot.
But I feel that way even about, like, James Franco. I've seen James Franco in things where I have really thought he was terrific. I thought he was terrific in 127 Hours, to be honest. I think his dealing with that guy's kind of gradual descent into panic was really interesting and really well done. But he's done other things where, obviously, I think it's just completely, I think there are at least as many failures as successes when he tries to be too ponderous.
Yeah. I mean, of all the actors that have been named here, I think James Franco kind of comes closest to my definition of a wild card, because Jack Black's always Jack Black, Tony Curtis is always Tony Curtis, and the projects move around them and fit them into different slots, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but they don't change. They're not the ones that you're like, what's he going to do?
Okay. That's partly because we're talking about actors.
Yeah.
And if you go back to, like, a creator, like, for me, Aaron Sorkin is one.
Yeah.
Some of the early Sorkin stuff, not just Sports Night, which I apologize for name-dropping Sports Night for the 156th time, but Also, like, I was a huge fan of A Few Good Men. I like The American President. There's a lot of that early stuff that I just loved, that I just thought was so charming, and I loved his ear for dialogue, and I loved to listen to his people talk. This is a little bit of Aaron Sorkin's mm-hmm. Questlove, right? Where yeah, I think there became a little bit of infatuation with his own image and genius, but also that moment of like, now I'm going to devote myself to big, important things. And I'm not sure that served him as well as yeah. talking about sports. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is, even though that seems to be a devolution because I don't like The Newsroom, there are things. I liked the Moneyball script. I liked a lot of the Social Network script. He still does stuff I like. It just depends on the thing. And for me, when you're a creator, you're less subject to that idea of the project is shifting around you. Mm-hmm. He is, in a way, always himself. You would never miss his touch on a script, particularly mm-hmm. in the dialogue. But at the same time, he's taking that style and applying it. And I think this is something that's been said about him, that it works much better when he's not trying to apply it necessarily to, now I'm going to tell you how things are going to be.
Right.
And when he sits back and sort of says, now I'm going to explain to you how the world works right. through my avatar, this put upon white
everything,
dude.
Everything would be solved if everybody just listened to this speech.
This handsome, blonde, harried white dude.
This yes. handsome, harried, creative white dude who nobody understands.
But I mean, that kind of ties back to the Grant Morrison thing, where it's a tendency. It is a flaw in that person's act that can yeah. make them insufferable if that's what they happen yeah. to focus on.
There is a difference between that, I agree, and the ones where it's the energy of the person that has to be harnessed by someone else. The Jack Black yeah. issue, which, by the way, is also my thing with Kevin Hart, who I actually like mm-hmm. in some
he's
movies.
The perfect analog, yeah.
I
yeah.
love mm-hmm. Kevin Hart in mm-hmm. some kinds of movies doing some kinds of things. Mm-hmm. In other kinds of things, I'm like, go away. I'm already exhausted, and it's only the trailer.
Like, he's exactly the analog when you said Jack Black. That was exactly popped in my mind.
Yeah.
Think Like a Man 2 is out now. And against my better judgment, I saw the first one, and I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
I liked that movie!
Did you really?
I did! I liked that movie, and I went in with such unbelievably low expectations.
I went in the same way. My friends actually went to hate watch it, and I actually walked out of it like, that was Kevin Hart was actually
Gene
like
Demme, my pal for life.
Like, just seeing him in the trailer now, sometimes like, oh, I can't do yeah. this, because he's like just manic, and you know.
Did you see Ride Along?
No.
It's too much of that.
Yeah.
I mm-hmm. needed Ride Along would have worked for me as like a format that doesn't exist, which is a 50-minute long movie. Mm. Like, if it was him and Ice Cube in a car mm-hmm. being cops for 50 minutes, that would work great. And
right.
I think I would have really enjoyed it. But mm. by the third act, you're like, oh.
Right.
I do think there's one more category, which is the artist who is simply so massively prolific and churns out so much stuff without necessarily having a great quality control filter.
You mean Prince?
Prince. Like, literally, as I was saying that, I was like, Prince. Ryan Adams, Anita Franco for a long stretch, M. Ward, who puts out these very rich, beautiful studio albums with his own name, but then he makes these things with Zooey Deschanel that are a different thing, and then he's in this
Wait, Zooey Deschanel is another one.
Zooey Deschanel
She's another one.
Very, very good example. I stumbled across something smart.
No, that's not what I meant. I was specifically sitting here thinking about the fact that we were talking almost exclusively about men, and I was wondering why that was. If it's just because
we're sexist.
I was wondering if it's because more of them are kind of have that auteur label. So when you start talking about directors and creators, or you know whether they're just more dominant or whether they were just people that we thought of or whatever. But Zooey Deschanel is a great example for me personally, and so frankly is Mindy Kaling, to put down two ladies of the Fox Tuesday Night Comedy lineup. They are actually both women who sometimes I really enjoy when they're doing the thing they do full on, and other times I'm very quickly tired.
Yeah, but that's like, that has to do with like how you feel. It doesn't have anything to do with empirically whether they are a wild card. Let's define our terms.
If we check the Silmarillion.
Exactly.
Well, it seems to me that the only people who can really help us resolve this are you, the listener.
I know that there's people out there, like Gary Oldman, okay? Gary Oldman is like a true wild card. There's other people out there.
Yeah. Glenn's in pain. Yeah. Glenn doesn't want to talk about Zooey Deschanel.
Tim
that's
Roth
what it
to a
is.
Certain extent.
Glenn doesn't want to talk about Zooey Deschanel. I think that's what's really going on here. Mm. But you can help us resolve this. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think. What does wildcard mean? Perhaps you are the listener who suggested this topic and you can tell us whether you are talking about the thing that Glenn is talking about.
I remember they suggested Edward Norton because they liked him in something and they didn't like him in something else. He's going by your definition too. The world's against me. Fine.
Fair enough. Well, you know, it is a time of year when many of us have a lot going on. As you listen to this, we have just had a live show, which I'm guessing went really well.
Sure did.
Didn't it go great? Let's just tape all the possible outcomes. Yeah.
It went great. There was a fire. but at any rate, we are busy this time of year, but we like to take a moment and engage in some of our favorite rituals. And one of our favorite rituals, I think it has been too long.
It has been too long.
Do you think it has been too long?
I think it's been too long since you've sung the song, Linda.
Oh, Stephen wants to hear the theme song. All right, are you ready? Mm-hmm. Okay. Regrettable television, pop quiz. Okay, so if you listened to the very first episode ever of Pop Culture Happy Hour, you heard us do the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz, in which what we do is we listen to a clip of a show, and then we guess whether we see whether those of us who did not submit it can figure out what it is. So hit me, Jessica Reedy, with our first clip.
I'll tell you what. You may not have been able to tell, but that guy had some serious cojones spitting at Todd.
Freaking nasty guy spit on me. Did you see that?
Yep.
I don't want to freaking have to wrestle a dude in a thong.
But you could totally pull off that look.
Boy, did you submit this, Thompson?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell it's yours.
It could be any damn thing.
Could be hillbilly anything.
Yeah, hillbilly wrestling.
Alligator spitting. Pumpkin seed spitting contest.
Wait, was the alligator in a thong?
It's definitely a reality show, right? We definitely
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Because
you can tell from that background.
It's not just unscripted. It's unscripted in scare quotes.
Yeah, very well.
I can just tell.
That's actually a hint.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Hillbilly, I don't know. Give me a half a point for me.
No, I can't.
Hillbilly handball. Something in a bar fighting. You know what I'm like? I'm like
hillbilly bar fighting.
You know what I'm like? I'm like Mo Rocca trying to figure out something on Wait. This is what he does. I give up.
All right, none of you are close. World's Worst Tenants on Spike TV.
Of course.
And this was in our summer quiz one time.
I would certainly hope so. This manages to be faker than reality television. Mm-hmm. It is three people, Todd Howard, Rick Moore, and Randy Howard. They roust out tenants who have to be evicted. They're like bounty hunters for tenants. And at the end of every episode, a little tag card comes up on the screen and says, reenactments of many of the actual confrontations that Howard and his team have experienced. Because, of course, they're not actually following them around with the camera crew. It's basically these people, as if they were just like at a bar, like, wasn't that crazy?
Oh, God.
So what happened is a one guy was like, whoa, dude, you can't kick me out. And the other guy was like, he spit on me.
That is literally just with actors.
Oh, man.
What this show is. It couldn't be lamer. World's Worst Tenants.
And you watch it because you're a landlord and you're just like, yeah, get out.
No, I picked it because I went on the internet and tried to find what's a bad show.
Yeah, okay.
Nice. How'd that go for you?
You tell me. World's Worst Tenants.
I guess you get a point. Yeah.
Actually, I went to the Spike TV website.
I'm sure there are lots of candidates there.
Yeah. Well, I like that. And as I said, I'm pretty sure that was in a coming up in the summer TV quiz that I did where it had something to do with, like, they were kicking people out of some – they were kicking out an illegal tattoo parlor or something like that. I'm pretty sure that happened. There's a listener somewhere out there who's like, she's not lying. There was a thing in there about
that was episode number 115.
I like to think that those people exist. All right, hit us again.
Autobiography of Malcolm the Tenth.
Malcolm X.
Oh? Malcolm X what?
Just Malcolm X. See, he changed his name because he didn't want to go by a slave name no more. I mean, it's great, Grandma. See, Malcolm talks about how, like, the black man was the original man, you know, the creator of great empires and civilizations. But we don't know that, see, because the history has been distorted.
By who?
by the old blue-eyed devil.
Frank Sinatra?
I got it.
Well, it's not mine. It's not Glenn's.
Nope.
So it must be Gene's.
Very, very, very fervent laugh track.
Yeah,
they were a little aggressive.
I was listening to that thinking, like, is this from 1958?
Yeah.
It's just because it's a very, very old sounding
laugh. I actually know what this one is. It's vintage, right?
Sort of vintage.
Yeah, I mean, sort of vintage.
Sort of vintage.
Yeah.
What sort of vintage?
Meaning not current.
That's all sort of vintage
not
means?
Not current.
Okay, yeah. All right.
That's what sort of vintage means.
All
like,
right.
Like pre-Clinton administration.
Okay. Oh, wow.
See? Right. Sort of vintage. Glenn Weldon.
All right.
But not so vintage that it references Malcolm X.
Yeah, exactly.
It can't predate Malcolm X, I suppose.
It's a little too. They would never mention Malcolm X on Family Matters.
No.
Did he think, do that?
I don't know.
Well done.
This is doesn't fit with That's So Raven. I got nothing.
It's not the Secret Diary of Desmond Pfeiffer.
Oh, hey.
Oh.
Is that it?
No.
That's so great.
That was a great guess. That was a great guess.
We are currently trying to remember all of television's more embarrassing efforts involving
Fields UPNE.
People of color.
Close.
Homeboys and Outer
Space. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that catalog is very long. I mean, you can.
Yeah,
it's
well, that's the impossible. Unfortunate thing is you can feel what's going on here as an effort to catalog all the really
space.
Bad.
They wrote a space hoopty.
Yeah, there was a Cadillac with a warp drive.
Can you give us a hint or should we just move on?
I think you should just tell him.
It was a show on Fox that aired in 1991 called True Colors.
Ah.
And the premise and the only joke in the show was that it was a blended interracial family. That's it. There was a widowed black father, and he married a white divorcee.
So was that like her mom or something?
That was her grandmother. That was her mother.
Her
right?
mother. So the grandmother of the family.
Grandmother and the,
talking about
and
Malcolm,
the youngest
Malcolm
black
X what?
Kid having an awkward dinner conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was
the way they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
In such a family.
That's as subtle as the show gets.
Any recognizable stars?
The grandmother was played by the woman who was in the Bounty or the Downey. Wait, no.
Mrs. With the quicker
with
picker
the upper? Yes, that lady.
Cora.
Yeah. Is it Nancy Walker?
The bounty woman is Nancy Walker. Yes, you're right. It's Nancy Walker.
I just want to say that I pulled the name Nancy Walker out of the ether.
I want that as my ringtone. I just want it known that I pulled the name Nancy Walker out of the ether.
All right.
How did you even know that? The father was played by one of the feckless police chiefs on The Wire, and then he was replaced in the second season by Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles.
All right, True Colors. So we're going to not look for that one on our reruns, probably.
Yeah, no.
Hit us with another clip.
That looks like a mugshot. Yeah, look.
Yeah.
Busted locals.
Okay. What was he doing?
Possession of a weapon of mass destruction?
Whoa.
I know this one. This one's mine.
Yes, of course you do. Love it for it to be catfish.
Yeah,
they go searching for somebody.
That's what it is.
That's what I thought.
It's not really catfish.
Yeah, it's really catfish.
That's so good.
It's really catfish. That's Max and Neve.
Sure, it is, yeah.
Now, Max and Neve.
Max's tiny little camera.
Yeah. If you've never seen Catfish, Neve was the guy in the documentary Catfish who met online the woman that he then found out was not what she advertised herself to be. And since then, since the documentary, Neve and his buddy Max have made a show for MTV where they go around and they investigate different cases of internet romances. And it always starts something like, well, he's been my boyfriend for 4.5 years. We've never video chatted because he has bad light in his room or something like that. So we just don't because he says the light's really bad in his room or he says his internet's too slow or something. So we don't video chat. But you know, look at all these pictures. He looks like a model. Like, he looks like the kind of person that you would see in many pictures around on the internet.
Yeah. He's just standing there with his hands on his hips and with a football under one arm.
And, you know, I really thought that we were close. That's why I gave him $500 a couple months ago. And we're pretty close. I'm pretty sure we're going to get married. I called him a couple weeks ago, and a lady answered the phone. She said that all she had was a 12-year-old daughter who spends a lot of time on the internet. So I don't know what it's all about. And
you
then,
know what it's all about.
And then Max and Neve have to investigate. And in this case, I guess we're investigating a guy who they found on Busted Locals. A site I'm sort of glad exists, I have to say.
That show is populated by the most implausibly... I don't want to say stupid, that's mean, but what I want to say...
Gullible.
Yes, that's gullible. Yeah.
They are implausibly gullible.
Yeah, I mean, Max and Neve, the high-tech tool they use, they seem to employ all the time is Google Image Search.
Yes!
They just type in... Yeah. They just drop a picture into the Google Image Search.
Or, like Facebook lookup.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I'm like...
These people are supposed to be millennials. This is supposed to be the language they speak.
Yeah. You could have done that.
It is infuriating.
There's been lots of coverage, though, about how scripted it is and how much the producers plot everything out and then just don't tell Max and Neve, and then Max and Neve have to kind of follow it through, and it just must hurt them. And how sometimes it's the different person who actually approaches them and not the person that they're...
There's been a lot of talk about the fact that they make it seem like it's the hunter for the person who does the casting, but that often the person they actually cast first is the person who is the catfisher.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of talk about kind of how they go about making this show. But to me, the other problem is how repetitive it is.
Yes.
That if you wanted an alternate title for this show, it could be Lovable or Size 24.
Because
that's pretty much the theme of about 85% of the episodes. Like 90% of them are, this person is somehow not what I thought. Frequently, it's I thought it was a man and it's a woman. I thought it was a woman and it's a man.
Mm-hmm.
Very frequently, it's I thought it was a thin person and it's a fat person.
Mm-hmm.
30-year-old and it's a 15-year-old or the other way around. But I think Lovable or Size 24 would be the,
And poor Neve keeps trying to make fetch happen, except not fetch, it's the word catfish. Just everything. Just stop.
This is a case of catfishing.
But I've heard that
catfish
all the time.
Catfish Tuesday.
In news accounts about the linebacker Manti Te'o when he was at Notre Dame, and he was catfished very, 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 very famously. You saw catfishing used as a verb in news stories.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
well, it is a word that sort of encapsulates a phenomenon. All right, so we have one more clip.
This is not awkward at all.
First thing I thought of when I saw Billy was, good, he's like big, tall, and strong. But does he have the right mentality to make it through this?
Hi, how you doing?
How's it going?
Nice to meet you.
I'm Billy.
I'm Kai.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. I see you're naked.
Yeah, I know. I'm naked too, and you're naked.
Yeah.
Oh my
God. I know what this is.
Thank you. I'm like so embarrassed right now.
Me too.
I know what it is. I know what it is.
Please tell us.
Because how many shows can there be where people meet and they're both naked?
Yep.
So therefore, this has to be Naked and Afraid.
Naked and Afraid on the Discovery Channel.
What?
Naked and Afraid?
Naked and Afraid?
Every week.
Oh, Gene, you need to watch Naked and Afraid so much. It is going to make you laugh so hard.
That's pretty much my baseline.
All the time.
As soon as you get home.
So most of us live most of our lives. I'm sorry, Glenn. Go
naked
ahead and explain.
Every week, a man and a woman are brought to, who do not know each other, are brought to some far wilderness. In this case, it's deep in the Louisiana swamps, and they strip their clothes, and for the next 21 days, they must survive. Because, well, that's where the show loses me.
Yeah.
I have no idea why. They don't win any money. Yeah. It's just to do.
Well, and they're always, like, wilderness people. Like, they'll be, like, they're wilderness experts of some sort, which is why they're expected to be able to drop in with literally nothing. It's like Survivor if you got nothing.
Right. It's basically, if you liked the Survivor Richard Hatch segments, it's just hours and hours of that.
And the thing that's funny about it is that you also get, one of the things that a show called Naked and Afraid is good for is getting a sense of exactly how they are and are not allowed to show naked people on a cable show, on a basic cable show.
Lots of butts.
So lots of butts. Butts are fun. No fronts. Mm-hmm. No, like, there are times when people, like, bend over in certain ways and they're not allowed to show certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You can't show if anything is, like, sticking out or there's very strategic blurring that goes on Naked and Afraid.
Now, they tend to be attractive, relatively attractive people.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, Billy, at least, was built like a brick house and had a very impressive pixelation, put it that way.
Right.
And, you know, you can tell yourself that there's an educational component to this, but there isn't. Because, like, I'm sitting there, and it's like, what would you do in this situation, Glenn? It's like, well, the easy way out is what I would do.
Yeah.
I would grab every toadstool, every berry, and just shove them in my mouth like they were bonbons. I was a 50s housewife in a mud pack and curlers. I would throw myself at the nearest gator because I've heard they drown you before they kill you, before they eat you. So that's like, oh, that seems kind.
So your choice would be sooner rather than later.
Right. Mm-hmm. You can go online on the Discovery Channel and get your PSR. They take this very seriously on the show, PSR, which is, of course, Linda.
It's your personal survival.
It's your primitive survival rating. Goes from 1 to 10. Or actually, I thought it went from 1 to 10. Turns out it goes to 0 because I took it. There's a 0.
Well, I will say there is one thing about this that I do find legitimately a little bit interesting, and that is watching the different reactions of men being naked around women they don't know versus women being naked around men they don't know. Hmm. It is common, not totally consistent, but in the ones that I've watched, the women will pretty quickly find some leaves or something to cover themselves up with. They much more want to do that early. Mm-hmm. Whereas the guys will just kind of stomp around for a while and be like, whatever. And the women do feel, I think, like, in order to sort of feel comfortable and start doing the work of getting food and all that stuff, they kind of want to cover up a little bit. They tend to, in my experience, look for that a little sooner.
In your experience watching the show.
Yes. Of all the reality shows I would go on, Naked and Afraid would be near the bottom of the list for several reasons. I mean, it's like, even if you were okay with the nudity, this is one of the few shows where I've ever seen people get really hurt. Like, if you cut your foot and it gets infected because you don't have any shoes and you don't, you know, you're walking around on rocks. There was a producer who got an extremely terrible snake bite while they were researching and who had to go to the hospital. And there was very grody footage of his leg. This is one of the few that I think is actually a pretty dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, it's dumb.
Naked and Afraid.
Naked and Afraid.
As we are all born and as we shall die. Naked and Afraid.
And now what's making us happy this week?
That brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week, other than being naked and afraid. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
There's a new record by a guy named Timothy Showalter who records under the name Strand of Oaks. And I'm listening to his new record. It's called Heal. It's very, very nice. And about midway through the record, there's a song on it called JM. It's 7.5 minutes long. And it is a tribute to a singer I've talked about a number of times, Jason Molina. I'm a huge Jason Molina fan. I've written about him on the site many, many times. He died early last year. And I have already, in part because I'm a big fan, I have written about a number of tribute projects. They've been very nice. This song is beautiful. Under the Market Street Bridge, burning one in my hand, I had your sweet tunes to play. Your sweet tunes to play. What is interesting about this song to me, it sounds very reminiscent of Jason Molina's music, while also sounding like this guy, Strand of Oaks. The structure of the song and the sound of the song and the solos in the song, as you heard, are very reminiscent of the Neil Young song Cortez the Killer. And Jason Molina went through this big Neil Young phase. It's all wrapped up in this song. And, like, it's weird, the line that he keeps coming back to is about the sweet tunes. You know, I had your sweet tunes to play. And that seems like kind of a corny line almost. But the whole song is following through, like, I had a really, really hard time when I was young. I did this, I did that, I had this rough situation and that rough situation, and through it all, I had your music. And so it's this very heartfelt, very sincere, very beautiful song that does right by its subject. Strand of Oaks, the song is called JM.
Thank you, Stephen. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Oh, boy, I got nothing. Let's lift the curtain a little bit. We are taping this 2.5 days after our last one so that we don't have to go right and do this show and then a live show the next day. So it's only been 2.5 days. During the week, I don't do anything. I go home and I write the book. Every day I write the book. But here's the thing. I am almost done the book. That's making me happy. When I am done the book, video games can come back into my life.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't played a video game over a year, maybe a year and a half, and it hurts. And I can't wait for the day when I can, instead of sitting down and typing at a keyboard, I can sit down all day and push buttons on a controller. That's it's a very different thing. Uh-huh. I'll still hate myself just as much because I suck, but for different reasons. Uh-huh. So I'm asking, I will beseech the listeners to please tell me what I should get. What's been out there in the last year and a half? I have a PS3. Yes, it's still a PS3. That's out there that you just love that I should get. Could be a game. It could be something, a downloadable content. Doesn't matter. Anything. I need it. I'm going to lock myself in a cave for a month.
Well, locked in a cave for a month is what is making Glenn Weldon happy.
With the help of our dear listeners.
Thank you, sir. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So last month, Stephen, on his first listen, shouted out this group that I never heard of called Sylvan Esso.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a duo. Both the singer and, I guess, the producer come from two separate acts mm-hmm. before when they came together for this project. I guess their lead single is the song called Coffee, which has probably the best hook of any song this year.
Get up, get down, get up, get down, feel the generation start, see the next one waiting. Get up, get down, get up, get down, get up, sentiments are same with a pair of feet change.
It's really, really, really addictive. It's like the song I play when on my little 6-minute walk to work in the morning. It's a great song.
Well, thank you, Gene. So I have two things. The first thing, you know, as we have done more and more episodes of this show, I knew this was going to happen eventually. And it has happened. I had my What's Making Me Happy already, and I mentioned it to Glenn. And he said, well, you know, I talked about that a long time ago. And I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway because it's what's making me happy. I talked about it on Twitter. I watched a documentary called Somme, which is about it focuses on four dudes who are going for the Master Sommelier exam.
Oh, yes.
They have to take this exam where they learn all about all kinds of wine. And there's basically three phases. One is a knowledge phase where they just take ridiculous amounts of, I'm not going to say trivia, but trivia about wine and, you know, regions and all that stuff. Then you have the service test where you have to be great and give good service because apparently that's part of it. The part they spend the most time on is the tasting part where they put six wines in front of you, three whites and three reds, and you have to try to identify them. You also have to describe all the notes that you detect in them. And if you think that you have heard the ridiculous things that people will say that wine smells and tastes like, you have not heard the full list until you watch Somme. And they clarify at one point, they're not literally saying that those things are in there. Like when they say, for example, that a particular wine has a quality of a new, freshly opened can of tennis balls, they're not actually saying it's made from a freshly opened can of tennis balls. And it really sounds like you could be playing $25,000 pyramid. Things you would not want wine to taste like. Wet wool, wet rotting leaves, old animal skin. What?
Oh.
Those are all real ones. And it's like, what? But they're enjoying it. You know, they're gulping down the wine. Glenn apparently talked about this documentary quite a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fun enthusiast documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's making me happy. The other thing, I hate to admit to any healthy habits whatsoever, but if you use Hulu a lot, Hulu has been advertising this service called Daily Burn. It gives you like a little workout every day, but it's like a different one and it refreshes it every day. And I have been using this and I will say it has managed to be usable for the better part of a week without making me feel like my knees are going to fall off.
There you go. Excellent.
And I'm very grateful for that because, you know, knees are hard things when you're an old lady. And so despite the fact that I got it from a plain old pop-up on Hulu, that has been making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's REEDY. And our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And as always, you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thank you to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Hey. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a B, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. Snap Judgment is stories made for summer. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.